Hey everyone, welcome to the Bass Hang Podcast. I am Steve Araujo. Today, my friend Robert Kearns, longtime bassist for Sheryl Crow, joins us. We have a great conversation. It's pretty incredible the people that he's played with. And I had no idea that he was actually in Lynyrd Skynyrd for a few years, which is amazing. He's got some great stories, and I always like to talk to bass players that are working and have been out there touring, recording, and I really like getting the insight onto how they approach gigs, how they approach recording, the gear they're using, of course, because this is the Bass Hang. We like to nerd out on that. But it's just really incredible. I really enjoy speaking to my fellow musicians, and these guys are out there working super hard. And obviously, the last couple of years have been a little trying, so I always like to find out how they spent their time, how they did some pivoting from being out on the road all the time to being home, and what they were doing. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. My buddy Robert Kearns, amazing Nashville bassist, plays with everybody, longtime Sheryl Crow bass player. So enjoy it. Robert Kearns, everybody. Hey, everybody. Steve Araujo here, the Bass Hang Podcast. I am super excited to have my friend Robert Kearns on today. Thanks for joining, man. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for asking.
Absolutely, man. And as you were saying, okay, so you were at the Super Bowl just yesterday.
Yes, we just flew back last night.
Okay.
So that's why I'm still kind of just got up a little bit ago. So.
And you play with Sheryl Crow, and you've been Sheryl Crow's bassist for some time now, right?
Yes, just over 10 years now.
Yeah. So what was the gig yesterday?
We actually played twice. We did a three-piece acoustic set, Sheryl, myself, and Tim Smith.
Okay. And where was it at one of the parties or in the
actual? Yes, they had two separate stages. We did like a VIP tent.
Okay.
On one side of the stadium. And we played about, I guess, 30 minutes or so on the acoustic set.
Very.
And then we left there and went over to the other side of the stadium, where they had a full huge stage set up in the parking lot, massive. And so we played there for about 45 minutes, a full band, electric.
Got it. So for the acoustic set, what do you... So it's all toned down. What do you play? Obviously, you don't play. Do you play?
I play actually electric bass, but it's sometimes it's just through the monitors, or we have in-ears, we use in-ears sometimes.
Dude, that's an easy setup. You just plug
in
good TI and that's it?
That's it. Yeah, yeah.
Were you able to watch the game at all?
No, they gave us Sheryl got to go with her kids, which was great and it actually turned out good for them because they're Kansas City fans. So,
and they're very happy with the outcome.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's cool. So basically I have some notes here.
Yeah.
Some notes. So where did you get? So right now you're in Nashville.
I'm in Nashville, yes.
And did you grow up in Tennessee, or where'd you grow up?
No, I actually grew up in North Carolina.
Wow,
yes,
okay.
Just a little town called Conover, North Carolina.
All right.
It's about an hour north of Charlotte.
Okay.
And about an hour and 15 minutes east of Asheville, North Carolina.
Very good. And schooling, you grew up, went to school there. Did you go to college?
I went to Newton Conover High School. Go Red Devils.
There we go.
I always try to promote them when I can. And I actually went to a community college there, Catawba Valley Community College,
nice.
CVCC.
Is that where you kind of started your music?
Well, I actually started taking lessons when I was a kid. I wanted to take guitar lessons, and my dad, he wanted me to play banjo. He loved the banjo. So we ultimately found a teacher, a guy named Bobby Denton, who's still a great friend of mine to this day, a mentor to this day. So he lived about 30 miles away in a town called Morganton, North Carolina. So my dad would drive me up there every week to take a lesson. So I would take two lessons. I would take fingerstyle guitar, like Chet Atkins
Sure.
style
Oh, man.
guitar, and then I would take a banjo lesson. So like the Earl Scruggs 5-string banjo
You don't get any better than
lesson from
that.
him.
Yeah, that's legendary.
Yeah. So I used to be fairly proficient. I never got to the point where I could like just take off and improvise on it, but I could do a lot of the Scruggs standard tunes, Flat and Scruggs. So it was fun. Yeah, it was a good early on, Bobby, I remember him telling my dad one time, because he was a great teacher, where he would play along with me when he would show me a banjo tune.
Okay.
But he would never, if I got off time, he wouldn't correct. He would just keep going with the correct tempo and time of the song. And then I would catch back up. So when I did that, he saw that I could do that. I could hear where I was supposed to be, but my fingers just weren't working correctly at the time.
It's
But
almost like
I remember him telling my dad, he was like, "Your son's got good time." So I was like, "Well, that's good."
a lot of the times you have to do the mind to the actual muscle memory connection, and that probably takes a little while, but he probably saw that you actually had something to give to that. So, and some
Exactly.
proficiency, absolutely.
Right.
So how
Yeah.
about so from banjo, guitar, and then you jump to bass, was that a big leap? And then also studying and reading music, how did you navigate that?
Well, so when I by the time I that was I believe that was in I was probably in 7th or 8th grade, something
Okay.
like that. And then of course, by the time I got to junior high school, then I caught the rock and roll bug. So then I wanted to move over to electric guitar.
Okay.
And I got an electric guitar for Christmas. And me and a buddy of mine, Jonathan Birchfield, who we still play together to this day,
That's fantastic.
when we can, we formed a little band in junior high school and just started playing around, practicing in the basement, driving our parents crazy with a loud racket down there.
As you're
And
supposed to do. That's the dream, you're
exactly,
supposed to do that.
Well, they were so sweet, to have to endure that every Saturday. Listen to our racket. But and another buddy, Greg Simmons, he played the drums.
Okay.
And then we formed a band. At that time I was just playing guitar, mainly rhythm. And let a guy named Alan Wilkerson play bass at that time. So we just I caught the rock and roll bug, so I kind of I didn't practice my banjo and the finger picking as much anymore. So, from there we played for a number of years until I got to where I graduated. And actually, Jonathan, he picked up another gig with a guy named Harry Dill and the Galaxies, who was like a local beach band legend.
Okay.
And so that at that point, I got an offer to go with this fairly successful regional band called Phoenix. But they needed a bass player. And what happened was, I was playing rhythm guitar at the time, and the drummer, who Dave Costner, who was the leader of the band, he said, "Well, we need a bass player." And I was actually working at a new music store that had just opened up in Hickory, Plaza Music, and we had a bass there. And I asked the owner, "Can I take this bass home and practice with it?" And fairly early on, it didn't take much time where I started, the drummer gave me a list of songs that they played, and I started listening to these songs, and it very soon I was like, "Oh, wow, I can hear the bass way better. I can pick out the bass and hear what the bass is doing much easier than the guitar parts." And
Interesting.
I just started playing the bass and practicing. I was like, And it dawned on me, it hit me. I was like, "Oh, this is the instrument I'm supposed to be playing, the
Wow.
bass," because it came to me more naturally, actually.
Sure.
So
Oh,
that's kind of how that went.
that's cool. And then how about, so do you read music and did you go through all that?
Well, now the reading part of the music came through in junior high as well. I joined the marching band.
Okay.
So I played saxophone in the band all the way through high school. So what little knowledge of reading music it came through the tenor sax. So
Wow.
reading music in the marching band. But from there, I kind of let that go by the wayside as well, and I've just picked up everything by ear.
Sure. But
But
now giving a chart or something like that, you can navigate your way through it for a second.
yeah, I
Yeah.
well, mainly here, we do the Nashville number chart.
Absolutely.
So
Yeah.
yeah,
I
so that's the kind of charts that I read mostly. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to kind of know your stuff. You got to know the fretboard. You have to know
That's
some
right.
kind of rhythms. You have to know, I've gotten
Exactly.
I've done some remote sessions for some friends, and yeah, they're great. But
Yeah.
it's really a fantastic way of writing down on a piece of paper and, a musical idea that's more than
Yeah.
just letters on top of words, and it's pretty fantastic. It's a great system.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Charlie McCoy and maybe some of the Jordanaires were responsible with coming up
With that system.
with that system. Yeah.
That's cool.
That, which is still in use, every day here in this city.
Oh yeah. So when did you make the jump to Nashville, or from playing in the local circuit to
Right.
actually, working your way up, I mean, a lot of it is definitely word of mouth, who you know. You get a job from a job, you get a gig from a gig, which
Yes.
all of us have, every working musician, that's kind of how it happens. But
That's right.
there's some jumps you have to make, and how did you make the leap and your move to Nashville? Because that's Music City,
What happened was in the 90s, me and my buddy Audley Freed, a guitar player who also plays with Cheryl now, we had formed a band. We lived in Raleigh, so I moved from my hometown of Conover to Raleigh, North Carolina, to join a big regional band at that point called Sidewinder.
Okay.
They had been on, I don't know if you remember that show. Ed McMahon had a show called Star Search,
Of course. Yeah, that was
but
a
they had
yeah.
been on that show and made it to the quarterfinals, which was huge back then. That was like the
That's
pre-runner before American Idol and
big time.
all the
America's
shows
Got That's
today.
predecessor. That was like
Exactly.
the
So
beginning of that.
that band had, and they were already kind of big on the East Coast.
Okay.
So I moved to Raleigh to join that band, and I played with them for 4 years. And then the last year that I was in the band, Audley Freed joined the band. So we were in that band for about a year. And then we decided, look, let's form our own band because we loved all the people in Sidewinder and playing with those guys. But we realized that for us to get, any bigger, we needed to play original music. So we formed our own band, and we were based out of Raleigh, where we were living. And we actually got a rehearsal space adjacent to the band. I don't know if you're familiar with COC, Corrosion of Conformity.
Oh,
We rehearsed right beside those guys, Pepper
kind of
Keenan and
metal
Woody.
hardcore band.
Yes,
Yeah.
absolutely. Yeah.
Late
Yeah.
90s kind of.
Yeah.
They're
Yeah.
still, I think they're still
They're
around, but
still playing.
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, I'm kind of dragging this out,
No,
but
you're fine.
after years of slugging it out, we ended up getting a record deal with Columbia Records, and we put out a album, and our first single actually went to number one on the rock AOR, the rock radio charts.
Okay.
For whatever that's worth at the
That
time,
sure.
but it ended up letting us be able to go out and open up for we opened up for Robert Plant and Aerosmith and ZZ Top, and this is in 1993.
Whoa.
So we had a song, I don't know By the title, you might not recognize it, but if you heard it, you may recognize it. It was a song called Peace Pipe. And it was number one for 4 weeks on that chart.
I'm going to put a link. So Peace Pipe by the band. What's the name of the band?
Yep, Cry of Love.
Cry of Love. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
I'll have people look for it. I'll put a little link, but that's
Yeah,
very
yeah,
cool.
yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, what happened was so after we toured for about a year and a half behind that record. It was called Br the album was called Brother.
Okay.
And we recorded it in Muscle Shoals, man. We which was always, we were huge fans of Muscle Shoals rhythm
Course.
section
Well, that's
and
world renowned. I mean, are you kidding me? That's what Dwayne Allman,
absolutely.
was all
Yeah.
those guys. Wow.
Yeah. Everything that they did down there, Bob Seger,
Yes. Yeah.
Paul Simon, Rod Stewart, the list goes on and on. And there's actually a great documentary about those guys.
I've seen
Yeah.
it. That's where I know a lot about that stuff. Yeah, that's a
Yeah.
great doc. Did you get to hang with any of them or see them?
Yes, they actually at the time we recorded, David Hood had an office there. Jimmy Johnson was still there. And Roger Hawkins as well. So those three guys were still at the studio.
Okay.
They were great, man. They would just tell us story after story, especially Jimmy Johnson. He got us in his office one day and told us about when Skynyrd recorded there, and we were just amazed. And in fact, on one of the songs, I think it was, don't Hand Me Down was the name of the song. The engineer Steve Melton, who engineered a ton of stuff back in the day at the from Muscle Shoals, he went and pulled out this box. It literally was like a wooden box, and we opened it up, and it was nothing but a kind of like a garden hose wrapped up in it. And it's called a Cooper Time Cube. And
Okay.
it's actually what Ronnie Van Zant used to sing through to get that doubling sound. So
Wow.
basically, on one end, it's got a Canon jack, and then it's got an input, and then it just goes through this hose. If I'm telling this correctly, someone
Look it up,
more
yeah.
technical may be able to explain it. But,
So kind of the
who
same
knows?
theory as like a talk box, but a different
Yeah.
purpose. Okay.
Well, it's basically just a delay is
Okay.
what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. And
Huh.
it's a doubling effect. But we use that on Kelly's vocal on the song Hand Me Down. So it really sounded, you got that Ronnie Van Zant sound.
Sure.
So but that was a ton of fun, hanging down there and hearing the stories from those guys, and recording was a great honor,
That's history. Well, and by
Yeah.
that time too, as you're, from playing at such an early age, being comfortable on stage and being comfortable in the studio and playing, I mean that it's the 10,000 hours thing that you had probably already gotten so that you're comfortable going into a situation and playing, and
Well,
not.
now, I mean, at that point, we had only been working. What had happened was we had a little four track. I think it was a Tascam four track, cassette. It was a four track cassette
Oh yeah.
recorder down in our rehearsal space,
Okay.
and we just recorded demos on that down there. And actually, Pepper from COC, those guys rehearsed right beside us. We had a demo tape, and they were going out on the road, and he asked Godley, like, "Hey man, can I get a copy of this, your little demo tape?" And Godley was like, "Yeah, don't play it for anyone though." So he got up to New York, and Josh Sarabin, who had just joined the A&R team there, he'd
Okay.
been working at Columbia, but they had just promoted him. He asked Pepper, he goes, "Hey man, I'm just new to A&R. I'm looking for a group to sign. Do you know of anybody?" And Pepper said, "Well, listen to this." He played him our demo tape. And from that, he came down to, we booked a show at the brewery where we used to play all the time. It's like our home club in Raleigh. He came down and saw us and signed us.
Wow.
But, But from there, from getting to that point to going to Muscle Shoals, we really didn't have any studio experience except for just recording in
Sure.
our little rehearsal space. And there was a studio that we did use a little bit in Raleigh called JAG Studio. A great guy named Byron helped us out a lot, and John Custer, our producer. But other than that, we didn't have any recording experience at all. So we basically went from the basement of our rehearsal space to being thrust to the Muscle Shoals sound, studio.
One of the
And it
most
was a
legendary
whole,
premier studios ever.
yeah, it was a whole new experience for us, And like I say, just an honor. We were just like, we were just blown away just to be there, much less recording our own music. So
Sure. What bass were you using back then? Like a P bass, an old P?
back then, I had a P bass, but I had just started playing. For years, I played a Les Paul recording bass.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's the bass that I used to record pretty much every track on that album.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I used that for years. Yeah,
Okay. You still have it?
yeah. I still have it. Yeah, yeah,
Nice. Nice.
yeah.
I love that. And then your
I may
drums.
have it in the other room back there. I can drag it out
Oh, well, yeah,
if
maybe I'll make you, yeah, so everybody can see it. You know, this will be
yeah.
on video too. And then,
Yeah.
so did everybody move to Nashville or make the move?
No, what happened? I'm sorry, I went
Oh,
the
no
long
worries.
way around.
I love the muscle. I mean, Muscle Shoals, man. That's amazing. That's such a rad story.
I'm sorry, I've gone down a rabbit hole of the whole history, but what
That's
happened
okay.
was basically after that tour finished up that I was telling you, we went out behind the Brother album. We were
Okay.
out on the road for a year and a half. We ended up parting ways with our original lead singer. So then we had a very hard time because he had a great voice. His name was Kelly Holland, great singer. But we had a very hard time finding a replacement for him, which finally we did in the form of a singer named Robert Mason.
Okay.
And we by the time we recorded our second album and the album came out, it was 2 years down the road. And we had just lost all of our momentum. In fact, I don't think, things had changed a little bit at the record company, and we didn't have quite as much push behind the record. And it was a different sounding album. Robert's a great singer. His voice just sounded a little bit different from Kelly, and people were kind of used to Kelly. But nonetheless, we recorded a great second album called Diamonds and Debris. And we kind of lost all of our momentum. So that, the writing was on the wall. We were kind of coming to the end as a band. So Audley went on after that to join the Black Crows. And
Man.
then Jason had already moved down, our drummer had moved down to Austin, Texas, and joined a guy named Chris Duarte, who's a legendary blues guitar player.
Okay.
And fairly soon after he was down there, maybe a year or so, I had gone back to school when I was telling you about CVCC. I was taking classes there. I'd moved back to my mom and dad's because my dad had had some health issues. But Jason called me. My dad was doing better, and he said, "Hey, man, we need a bass player." And I told Chris about you. So I ended up moving down to Austin, Texas from my hometown where I'd moved back to. And I lived down there for about 5 years. And the way I got to Nashville was, and while I was down there, I played with a guy named Jack Ingram, great Texas artist. I played with Chris Duarte for about a year. And I immediately, after Cry of Love split up, I'd played with joined this great band from Festus, Missouri called the Bottle Rockets.
Okay.
And so I had played with them, and I was playing with them when I'd moved to Austin, but we had taken a little hiatus as well. So anyway, what happened was a great friend of mine, Sean Seamus Bacon. He was running in front of house for a country artist named Chris Cagle, and they were in need of a bass player. And I happened to have like 2 weeks off, and Chris was a fan of Cry of Love. So he was like, man, come up here. He had called me a couple of times. He's like, come up here and, play bass with me. So I decided to come up, not knowing what to expect. So, and that was in 2005. So I came up, played with Chris. We went out and did about a 2 week run. And then I just decided, I'm going to move to Nashville.
Sure.
So that's how I got to Nashville was in 2005.
Okay.
I took this country gig with Chris Cagle and played with him for 2 years. And then Jack Ingram, who I was playing with in Texas, he was coming up nationally. He had a number one hit on the country charts called Wherever You Are. So
Okay.
that had hit big. And so he wanted me to come back and play with him. So I went back and played with Jack for another 2 years, but I still remained in Nashville.
Okay.
So I've been here since 2005. So that's how the move happened. Sorry for the long
No,
back
I love it, man.
history.
Was it, did you, so obviously playing with these people, did you pick up other gigs, other sessions? Obviously, being around
Not so much at that time. It took me a little while from being in town, to kind of get my
establishing.
name established out there. But yeah, mainly I was just doing the Chris Cagle gig and then the Jack Ingram gig. And a few, I would pick up a few things here and there, but
Sure.
yeah.
That's cool, man. And then
Yeah.
how the Sheryl Crow gig. I mean, that's
Yeah.
you did you have to like in the big picture, did you have to do a lot of auditions, not just with Cheryl, but other people? Did you prep for that or did you?
Yeah. Well, I'll continue on with my history a little
I love
bit.
it.
Well,
I love
what
it. Do it.
happened was when I went back to Jack Ingram, I played with him after playing with Chris Cagle for 2 years.
Okay.
I played with Jack for about two years. And then I had decided I was going to leave and go play with a buddy of mine. I got offered to do a gig with Edwin McCain. I don't know if you know who Edwin
Yes.
is,
Yeah.
but he's a great artist, great singer, songwriter. And he had offered me the gig to play with him. So I was like, sure. So I started playing with Edwin, and I had only been playing with him a month or two. And I got a call from Ricky Medlock, who I had had a little bit of a rapport with from when we were in Cry of Love. Audley and I, we opened up a couple of shows with Blackfoot, which was his band, Blackfoot. And then at this time, I think in 1997, when we put out our second album, Cry of Love, he had gotten a job with Lynyrd Skynyrd. So he was back with Lynyrd Skynyrd. So I had just started playing with Edwin, and Ricky called me and he said, Robert, he goes,
Wow.
we're looking for somebody to fill in on the bass position with Skynyrd. And so he said, listen. And this is, I'll never forget this, Ricky. He told me, matter of factly, he was like, listen, I'm telling you now, if you go and learn Leon's bass parts exactly like they are on the record and come into this audition, this was an audition I had to do for Skynyrd. He said, just learn the parts exactly. That's all they want. They don't want any more, any less. Just play them. And I spent many hours breaking down Leon's bass parts and trying to learn them exactly. But that's what I did. And so I had an audition for Lynyrd Skynyrd, which was huge, for me. Like,
Well, for anybody, I think. I mean, that's
yes.
such a legendary band. And that's big shoes to fill. Huge.
Huge, huge shoes to fill. Well, actually, what had happened was, they had a great bass player at the time, Ian Evans, who had taken over for Leon when Leon had passed. In fact, Leon had kind of taken Ian under his wing, and he was out on the road with Skynyrd, and Leon would show Ian, on this part, you do this, play this here. But unfortunately, Ian was sick. He had taken ill. So they were just looking, basically the audition was just for someone to come in and take the position until Ian could get better to come rejoin the band.
Yeah.
So that's what it was. And I remembered, I came in the room. The audition was at Blackbird Studio here in Nashville. And I came in, and the way that the band set up, Leon was always on Gary Rossington's side of the stage
Okay.
and stood right beside Gary. So when I went into the audition, that's the way they had it set up. And I was set up right beside Gary Rossington, which was like, man, holy cow, there's the guy that I've stared at for hours on
Yeah.
on these album covers.
So you
And
had never
now I'm
met
gonna,
any of them, you just walk in and boom.
well, I knew Ricky,
Okay, you knew
sort of
Ricky.
knew Ricky.
Sure.
I had a rapport with Ricky, but never met any of the other guys, and they were just the sweetest and still are to this day. Johnny, just they were all great guys. And so I went in and I felt like I played okay, and I felt like I did all right. But I was one of the first ones in to play. So when I came out, I saw all these other, like A-list bass players waiting. And I was like, uh-oh.
Man.
But, eventually, so I got a call back. They didn't tell me anything. So I got a call back to come back and to audition, because at the same time, they were needing a bass position. They were also needing a keyboard player because Billy Powell had just passed.
Oh, got it.
So I got a call back to help audition the keyboard players. So
Wow.
nobody's telling me anything. So I'm thinking like I'm going to play a couple of songs and somebody else is coming in. So
Sure.
we start trying out these keyboard players, and I remember just playing, and I'm kind of looking around. Nobody says anything, so they keep coming in, these keyboard guys, and I'm still here playing. And we just go through the songs. I'm like, okay, I'm thinking to myself, this seems pretty good.
I'm still
So
here. I'm still playing,
I'm
so.
still here. I'm still playing. So anyway, so we try out all these keyboard guys, and at the end of the thing, everybody, we go into the break room and nobody says anything, and they're talking about the keyboard guys. And so I'm like, okay. And then finally Ricky says, he goes, "Hey Robert, by the way, welcome to the family." So I'm like, oh my gosh, so
Man,
that was
so how long did you play with Lynyrd Skynyrd?
I ended up playing with them for 3 years. And unfortunately, rest his soul, Ian never recovered to
Oh,
join the
man.
band. So, he unfortunately passed, and then I was the bass player.
That's amazing.
So what happened is during that time, we had formed a side band called Big Hat. It was myself, Audley Freed, Fred Eltringham, on drums. Keith Gaddis was our lead singer. We had Peter Stroud, who was Sheryl Crow's longtime guitar player.
Okay.
So, and I think they were on a little bit of a hiatus because Sheryl had recorded a R&B album with Doyle Bramhall, and she had this longtime band, but when she went out to tour behind that R&B album, it's called 100 Miles from Memphis, she formed a whole new band to tour behind that. So
Interesting.
Peter had kind of been working. He had played off and on with Sarah McLachlan and some with Don Henley, but he said, "Hey, let's form this side band," and we called it Big Hat. So anyway, we went down and recorded a demo down at Southern Tracks in Atlanta,
Okay.
and we never really went out and played live. We just recorded that demo, which was a ton of fun.
Sure.
And so what happened was Sheryl she had finished up the tour behind that R&B band, and she needed a band. She wanted to get a rock band back together. And there was a benefit down in New Orleans for the hurricane relief,
Katrina.
I believe it was.
Yeah.
And it was put on at by Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie were together at that point. And it was a huge deal. So she needed a band. So she went to Peter and said, "Hey, I need a band, you know, to do this benefit." And Peter said, "Well, what about these guys I've been playing with, you know?" So we did a rehearsal in Nashville, and it went fairly well. I'm not certain that Cheryl was convinced at the time that I was the right guy, but everybody, Audley and Fred, and actually at the same time, they brought in Josh Grange, who's a steel guitar player.
Okay.
So, we all kind of met and rehearsed at the same time with Cheryl. So anyway, initially she was like, "Okay, we went down and did the benefit and it went okay." And so she was like, she needed a band for the summer. So she was like, "Okay, well, I'm going to offer this band the job for the summer." So basically what I had to do was I had to think about, okay, so I've got this, on one hand, I'm playing with Lynyrd Skynyrd, which I know is a secure, great gig that 1,000 bass players would kill to have.
Yeah.
Or over here, I can play with Cheryl with all of my buddies, you know, and it's uncertain whether this is going to go on after this summer. It's only guaranteed through the summer. Mm-hmm. So, man, I agonized over that decision. Because I was going to have to leave Skynyrd to go do the Cheryl gig, which was only guaranteed through the summer.
Sure.
So, man, I agonized what to do over that gig. But so I finally just made a decision to go for it. I was like, I'm just going to go for it and see what happens.
Wow.
And so I did. I had to tell the guys in Skynyrd, you know, I was going to go. Play with Cheryl, and it was hard. It was the hardest thing in music I think I've ever had to do. But as it turned out, you know, we played through the summer, mm-hmm. and at the end of the summer, Cheryl called and offered me the gig on a permanent basis. You know, so it worked out. So
that's a huge, like,
that was,
I
yeah,
I can't even imagine. Wow.
It was it really it took a toll on me emotionally to make those phone calls. Cause I called everyone individually to tell them, cause I didn't want anyone hearing through the grapevine, you know, and especially Johnny and Ricky and Gary were so sweet to me, and they still are to this day. I just went to see them a couple of months ago, play at the Ryman, and they sounded great. And they're still so sweet, and, you know,
well, it sounds like you did it the right way. You were, you know, you did it the right way. You didn't
believe
and
well, there's no reason to, you know, with people that are that talented, and it's a legacy band, and you know, and they bring such joy to the fans still to this day. And you never want to, you know, burn bridges or leave on a sour note, or at least I don't anyway.
I think that gives you longevity in your career too, and just and actually a clear conscience, you know.
Like, yeah.
You be a good person, and you have to be nice, you know, no matter what. So you did it. You did it the right
way.
Well, you
know? If you think about it, because you know, I never up until the Skynyrd gig, I had never really made any real music. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd never made any real money. You know, I was always living just kind of hand to mouth in the music business. I was just so stubborn to quit. But I mean, I made enough. I wasn't, you know, living in poverty, but I made enough to pay my bills, but never really was able to, you know, store anything back, you know, for a savings. Yeah. But those guys, you know, they not only, you know, the prestige of having that gig, but it kind of took me up to a to the a next level, you know,
absolutely, yeah,
to be able to say that I played with those guys. So I owe them a debt of gratitude, you know. So and I just I, you know, I still love them to this day. So
well, I'm sure the feeling is mutual too. You know, you stepped in and you did a good job. You honored, you know, the
well, I tried to.
Yeah,
I tried to do my best. So
that's all. And so the Cheryl thing, what year was that?
That was in, so I got the Skinner gig in 2009, and I played with them from 2009 to 2012. And then that's when I jumped over and started playing with Cheryl in 2012.
And it's been ever since. And man, Cheryl is, I mean, you're a monster bass player. She's an amazing, like, just musician. And she's a killer bass player.
Oh, yes. All around. Yeah. Well, you know, she has a degree in music from the University of Missouri. And so, yeah, she can. She's a fantastic piano player. In fact, she can kill it on the piano. Mm. And everything else. She's a great harmonica player.
Sure.
She plays bass, guitar.
Yeah.
She's just, you know, all around. And sings unbelievably, you know, her. I don't think that I've ever heard her hit a bad note.
Wow.
And she can just, you know, she can kill it. So, and she
wow.
brings it every night. So.
Yeah, yeah, she's amazing. So, and then that band, is that the band she takes in the studio, recording?
Sometimes, you know, what's a lot of times in the studio, she actually plays the bass.
Okay.
But
got
sometimes
you.
She'll write the songs on the bass and,
sure.
And her, if she doesn't write the song by herself, she co-writes a lot with Jeff Trott.
Okay. Yeah.
And they've had a lot of her hits were co-written with Jeff.
Wow.
So, and so when they're writing together, if I'm not mistaken, I think she plays bass a lot of times. So she'll just lay down the bass track herself.
That's so cool, man.
But I have had the privilege of recording bass for her on a number of tunes. So that's been an honor.
That's awesome, man. That's rad. Thank you. I love the history, and I didn't realize that you had played, that you were in Lynyrd Skynyrd for those years. That's legendary, man. That is.
Oh, man, it was such an honor to play with those guys. But
And you're still friends with them, and
they
love you. You still love them, and you have that camaraderie. That's something that'll never be taken away, you know, and that's a testament to you. So that's awesome, man. Wow.
Thank you.
So then, you know, obviously, in 2020, we had COVID. You know, everybody was out on the road, and then March, April of 2020, it just shut down. You guys were touring right before, on the road, and then everything kind of came to a halt, huh?
Yes, we really didn't do anything for too much of anything for 2 years.
Okay.
Although Cheryl was, she was very gracious in the fact that she what we did do and what she wanted to do was we just we did some home videos of some of her hits, but we actually played them live. We all had our own little recording ways to record our own parts, and then we would video that as well at the same time, and then she would just put a compilation video of all of us together at home playing, you know, some of her hit songs.
I think I've seen some. It's interesting the way that people pivoted and had to.
Yes. Absolutely.
And kept it alive, you know. And I, you know, you, Cheryl, to everybody, you know, they pivoted to this new model of virtual concerts, of virtual.
That's right.
You know, the Bass Hang has had a podcast forever. When I first started the Bass Hang in 2010. But we started this thing called the Big Bottom podcast with Tony Puleo from GK Amps, Blue Man Group, and my buddy Jonathan Moody from GHS.
Oh, cool.
And we just were like, you know what? We're in quarantine, so let's do this podcast. So we talked to a bunch of people, and, you know, it was just something to do to keep, obviously, mentally stable and mentally, I mean, I don't know, it was emotional and it was weird because you couldn't hang with people. You couldn't. So it was almost the next best thing.
And you saw a lot of people pivoting, and it was, thank God we had that,
I know.
and everybody was able to, and Zoom, everybody was doing Zoom things, and it was a way to, you couldn't physically be close, but at least this way you felt closeness, and it was a way to get around it, I think
Absolutely.
emotionally. Were you doing more home stuff? Did you yourself pivot to a different, doing home recordings, remote sessions? How did you navigate that?
I did a few home recordings, but mainly those videos for Cheryl, the way that we would put those together, that kind of kept me going for sure. And then, man, outside of music, I just did a lot of home projects, just things I needed to do around my house. I had learned how to and YouTube's amazing, as you know,
Oh
but
my
you can
gosh.
learn so many things. I painted my garage door and I painted it where it looks like it's wood, if from 10 feet away, but you get up on it, it's paint.
Basically, it's YouTube University.
That's it, yeah.
Any tutorial that you, from fixing a dryer to painting, you just, okay, YouTube, how to do this, and you'll find something,
That's
so
right.
that's amazing.
Me and a buddy of mine, Shaky Folks, who's a great drummer here in town, but also he knows his, he's a he can he's a, he can do everything. He's a Renaissance man. But he and I built a shed. I built a storage shed in the back on my back property. And then I got the bug to I've collected posters of gigs that I've done over the years, but I've had them stacked up. I've had so many and I've never done anything with them. So then I finally got the bug to start framing those up. So that was one of my projects. I just tried to keep myself busy,
That's awesome. And then what was it, 20, late 21, no, late mid 22 was kind of when everybody started kind of going back on the road, right? Was it spring 22?
We went out a little bit last year.
Okay, got it. How was it? Did you find it kind of cobwebs, or was it just?
Man, for me it was great because I'm one of the only single guys in the band, and I don't have any kids or anything. So I told our tour manager, I said, "Hey man, you can book this tour beginning in first of spring, and I don't care if we don't come home until the end of fall because I'm so sick of being in this house by myself. I'm over it." But of course, everybody else, they're married and they have kids, and
You have to respect everybody's, wherever
that's
they're
right,
at mentally. You got to
that's
respect that.
right, that's right. And I think a lot of people have gotten used to being home, during the pandemic. So, and that's cool. But I was just raring to go, and it was okay. It did take a little time to adjust to being back out on the road after not, you get in the tour bus and start heading down the road, and the first night it always takes me a couple of nights to adjust to the rocking back and forth in your bunk to get asleep. But after night two, I'm good to go. So
That's awesome, man. I'm so glad. And right now, obviously, you're back out touring, playing whatever gigs with Cheryl.
I think we just have a lot of one-offs actually this year. I don't know if we're out full on the road or not, but all the dates haven't come in yet.
Got
So,
it. Yeah, they'll start coming in. That's awesome. All right, so a couple of questions for you. What is your, so when you go on tour, must have gear that you obviously there's the bases that you have. Do you have certain things that you really need, and maybe even people out there wanting to tour, like what are your must-haves?
It depends on the gig, but obviously with the Cheryl gig, which is the main thing, I have to have, because some of her hits like Happy, If It Makes You Happy, and Every Day is a Winding Road. Those songs require a five string bass because there's a couple of spots in the song where it goes down. It incorporates the low. I don't know if it the low B string. I don't know. It's not a B note, but it goes down to a C, I think. Winding Road goes down to a low C.
Got to hit that low C, yeah.
Yeah, and I do it, you know, I could learn it on the four string, but I try to keep true to the way, you know, when that song was recorded, a lot of the five string was, you know, I think a lot of people were just coming on and it was really being incorporated in a lot of recordings during that time in the 90s. But so I use a five string. There are certain pedals that I use for her songs, such as All I Want to Do is Have Some Fun on the chorus of that song, which is really cool. There's an octave pedal. So there's a, I use a Boss OC2 octave pedal, which is still my favorite octave pedal to this day.
It's one of the is it an older one?
It's an older one, yeah. In fact, I have a couple of them just for backup, just in case.
it's one of the there's a few of them that have that. Well, it's like an analogish type of sound too.
Yes,
and the imperfection of it is almost the appeal.
Exactly.
Right? Because it's not perfect. And sometimes you have to play, you have to adjust your playing in a certain way to bring that note out, you know? And then obviously I think it's what the C on the A string, the third fret is kind of the lowest that you can do, because if you go lower, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Right. Then it starts gurgling and wobbling. So you have to, but the imperfection is kind of the thing with that pedal, with the OC2, it's the vibe.
I never go that low. So,
yeah, you can. Yeah. You can, but, with the OC2.
yeah. But I like it just, first off, the tone of that pedal, it to my ears, it sounds great. And it actually, it tracks it fairly well. For me, it works just on the passages that I use it on. So, I have to incorporate I incorporate the octave pedal. And then there are a couple of songs of hers that I use a fuzz or an overdrive pedal on pretty heavy. There's a song she's got called Steve McQueen. And in the middle bridge of that song, there's a fuzz bass.
Which pedal do you use for that?
There is a pedal on that one. I use a kind of an obscure pedal called a Fender Sublime pedal. It's a huge pedal. It's probably a foot long, and it's green, and it's got this lighted dial. The more that you turn the fuzz all the way up, it goes from green all the way to red. Of course, I have it up all the way.
Just grindy. Yeah.
So, and they're a little bit hard to. I looked on. I probably shouldn't even be saying it because people.
Don't. Yeah, I think they stopped making that pedal a while ago.
They stopped making them. I looked on Reverb not too long ago, and they were, you know, they're like $250 now or something. They're getting up there. But anyway, so I used that on Steve McQueen, and there's another song called A Change Would Do You Good that has a fuzz bass all the way through it. So I use it on that one. And then there's a on this last she put out a documentary last year. It came out on Showtime, and she redid the Rolling Stones song Live With Me.
Okay.
And the way that she and Jeff Trott recorded it, it's got a fuzz bass on it as well. And for that, I use the, what's the name? I'll think of it in a second. I just had it on my brain. But I use a different fuzz for that one. Yeah.
Amplification-wise, you have all your backline?
For years, I was an Ampeg SVT guy. I mean, that's what I used all through Cry of Love. Chris Duarte, Bottle Rockets, and Skinnerd. I had two SVT rigs with those guys. But what's happened is it's become a little bit, I got down to where it was a little bit too much volume for our gig with Cheryl.
Okay.
So, and I had gotten down to where I could just barely crack it on, and it still seemed to be a little bit too much. So I've switched over to this head. It's called a Fat Jimmy.
Okay.
Head, and it's hand wired. There's a guy out of the San Francisco Bay Area that makes them, and they're great heads. It's just like a 100-watt bassman.
Sure, all two.
But man, it puts out a ton of sound, and so I just have this 100-watt tube head that I play through an Ampeg SVT 410.
Oh, 410, okay.
Yeah. So that seems to work fairly well because it doesn't seem to you know, the SVT is so huge, and it just goes, you know, as bass waves do, they just go everywhere.
But it's the sound.
And it is. Oh, yeah.
If you don't have to be lugging it around and you can have it set up for you, that's
that's the best of both worlds. I kind of relate the Ampeg SVT for bass players to how a Hammond B3 and a Leslie is for key organ players, because it's got that same signature sound. There's nothing that sounds, in both cases, there's nothing that sounds like a Ampeg SVT or a Hammond B3 Leslie cabinet combo, but they're beasts to move.
That's the caveat, you know, but that's exactly. You know, if I show up the back line and I see like an SVT with an 810, I'm like, oh, this is beautiful. It's just absolute power and absolute sound. It just sounds good. That's the tone. No matter what bass you're plugging in, it just sounds good.
You can get an incredible sound. Yeah, no problem.
That's cool, man. Do you have any Spinal Tap-ish moments from a gig that, like, one moment that just super Spinal Tap? Because almost every gig has Spinal Tap moments.
Yeah. You know? Oh, I'm sure I have a ton of them. I do remember right off the top of my head, I can remember when Audley and I and Jason and Kelly were in the band Cry of Love. I think we were out in the San Jose area, and we had to do a we did a lot of radio, visiting radio stations and making appearances here or there. But for some reason, they had us at a go-kart facility, which was like an entertainment complex. But this radio station decided that they were going to do a live remote from a go-kart facility, which, had, video games and other stuff. But the main thing was a go-kart. So we're out there. We're trying to play acoustic, our song's acoustic, with these go-karts going by. And we're having a hard time hearing ourselves, much less anybody else who was there. So I was just thinking to myself, like, man, this is very Spinal Tap here.
Absolutely. That's awesome. How about a very memorable gig moment? Just super memorable, live or whatever. Just something that stands out that, wow, that was rad. I mean, obviously you've had Muscle Shoals, you've had brushes with, obviously gigging Skinnerd and all these people. Any real memorable moments from a gig?
Well, last year I got a call to go fill in. This was on a Thursday. I got called from Mickey Raphael, who is Willie Nelson's longtime harmonica player since 1973.
Okay.
And their bass player, fantastic bass player, Kevin Smith, acquired COVID. So he called me on a Thursday and said, Robert, are you busy this weekend? I was like, well, I'm not gigging. He goes, can you come to Austin and play with us? It was Willie's, all these things aligned. It was a Willie's 89th birthday. They were opening up a brand new center arena in downtown Austin called the Moody Center. Willie was opening for George Strait in the round at the Moody Center. And he gave me a whole list of songs, and they sent me a board tape. And this was about this time on a Thursday, I don't know, 11 or so. And I practiced all night, all day into the night. And the next morning I was on a flight to Austin. I got picked up, went straight to the room, tried to practice a little bit more, but then immediately had to go over to the gig and tried to go over some of the tunes with the guys in the dressing room. And then, I went out and we played the gig. I went up to the stage. I never saw Willie until he walked up the stairs. He looked over at me and gave me a nod. And we kicked off Whiskey River. They counted it off and right into Whiskey River. And man, I got goosebumps. I was like, this is incredible. It was Willie's birthday. And the first night I did, I got to say, I thought it was like maybe 80-20. There was about 20% there.
Sure.
And this is just my take. You may ask somebody and they may say, no, it was worse than that. But there was a couple of, what happened was there was a couple of sections mm-hmm. where I got tangled up because they sent me a board tape, but Mickey had warned me. He was like, listen, you just got to have big ears, which you need to have big ears on any gig. But he said with Willie,
sure.
He goes, you've got to, because he may not do the song the same way. He may, you know, leave out a verse, or he may
jump
leave out the bridge,
sure,
or he may, you know, add something. So what happened was that the hardest part of the set was there was a medley of songs between "Ain't It Funny How Time Slips Away" into "Crazy" into "The Nightlife."
Yeah.
So we're going through, and I get through the first two all right. Well, we get to "Nightlife." And then Willie launched, so he, and I tried to chart out as much as I could, you know, we got to "Nightlife" and he started playing a solo. Well, on the board tape I had, there was no solo. He hadn't played a guitar solo on that night. So he launched it to a solo and I'm like, uh-oh. I'm like, now is this over the chorus or the verse or the? And I wasn't sure because it was just me, you know, and Billy the drummer and Mickey, and you know, Mickey was just playing fills.
Sure.
At that point, he hadn't launched into playing a solo, and so I was trying to like, what part of the song is this solo?
Yeah.
So I got a little bit that got a little sideways for me. But we eventually got back, I got it back together and reeled it in. But for the most part, but then the next night, of course, I thought it went, I did about as good as I could have possibly done on the Saturday night. And, of course, all the writers and critics were there on the Friday night. So they didn't see. But anyway, it was just an honor for me to look over and like, oh my God, there's Willie, you know, I'm playing with Willie Nelson on his birthday in the round at a brand new opening of a downtown arena in Austin, Texas, where I used to live for 5 years.
Sure. Now, crazy. Did you get to talk to Willie or
I did. So on the Sunday, they had a birthday gathering for tons of notable artists out at Luck Reunion. Where Willie lives, they had a whole birthday show for him. You know, Steve Earle was there, Robert Earl Keen, Margo Price, Cheryl was there, just tons of artists, Ray Wiley Hubbard, on and on and on, as you can imagine. So before Willie came out, what happened was they were so nervous about him getting COVID, they were keeping him quarantined. They really didn't want him to be around anyone.
Sure.
As you can imagine, you know. So they kept him sequestered. So and until right before, you know, Cheryl and Willie are really good friends and have been for a number of years. So Annie, Willie's wife, told Cheryl, like, look, we're going to come over here about 10 minutes before Willie goes up to play, because he played an hour after all these artists did a tribute to him. He got up and played about an hour set. Wow. And she said, we're going to go over here and you can meet with Willie over here. So when I got over there, you know, I got to go with Cheryl, and you know, she talked to him mainly, but he looked over and he goes, sounded good up there, you know, which was really, I was like, thank you, sir. It was just an honor to play with, you know, and he was very sweet. He let me take a picture with him, and
legendary. Well, that's a testament to you too. You know, there's nothing like being a working musician, I always use the 10,000 hours thing. Like, you've had that experience, and that, you know, culminates into you being on stage, last minute gig, having the ears to actually pull that off. You did your homework, but obviously, you know, everything changes. I mean, I don't think I've ever been on a gig where everything goes as planned. It never does. So you always for it, you know, and
that's right.
You know, going into a solo and you're like, okay, is this the verse changes? Are these the chorus changes? What are the changes? So, you know, it's a testament to you and just your ability to step up and do that, and to do it with such a legend, man. That's
incredible.
That's amazing, man. Well, dude, I you know, that this has been so fun. I hope it's been fun for you.
It has. I don't do a lot of interviews, actually, so this is I get nervous sometimes. So I hope
You did great, man. And you know, I really appreciate your friendship and really getting to know you. And one of these days when you're out here, Southern California, if I'm traveling, I would love to come and see the show.
Absolutely.
Cheryl's just so legendary, and she's so talented, and I'm just so excited for you, you know, being part of that band, and just, it just seems like such a rad, like a happy band, you know, really
cool. It is. Yeah. And that comes from her, you know, that comes from the head down. So she keeps it that way. She's good like that. She's really, really good.
That's amazing, man. Well, it's been a pleasure, Robert. And as I kind of end all these interviews, we go into the green room. So I stop recording, but we're going to still keep chatting. We're going to some industry secrets.
Okay.
All right, man. Robert, I really appreciate you, man. Thank you for talking. And everybody, big hand out there. You know, when you're watching, everybody's going to be clapping. All right. Thanks again, Robert. I'm going to stop the recording and then we're going to keep talking. Bye. All right, bud. I'm